Chapter 24. I'm in Canada, she's in New York. I'm in Vegas, she's in Los Angeles. We stay connected by phone. One night, she asks for a rundown of my favorites: song, book, food, movie. You've probably never heard of my favorite movie.
Tell me,
she says. It came out several years ago. It's called Shadowlands. It's about C.S. Lewis, the writer. I hear a sound like the phone dropping.
That's impossible,
she says.
That's simply not possible. That's my favorite movie.
It's about committing, opening yourself to love.
Yes, she says. Yes, it is, I know.
We are like blocks of stone. Blows of his chisel which hurt us so much are what make us perfect.
Yes, yes, perfect.
Playing in Montreal in the semis against Kafelnikov, I can't win a single point. He's number two in the world and puts a beating on me that causes people in the stands to cover their eyes. I tell myself, I have no say in the outcome of this match. I have no vote about what's happening to me today. I'm not just being defeated, I'm being disenfranchised. But I'm okay. In the locker room, I see Kafelnikov's coach, Larry, leaning against the wall, smiling. Larry, that was the sickest display of tennis I've ever seen. I'm going to make you a promise. Tell your boy he has a couple of beatings coming from me. Later in the day, I get a call from Stephanie. She's at LAX. I ask, how'd you do in your tournament?
I hurt myself.
Ah, I'm sorry.
Yes, that's it. I'm done.
Where are you headed?
Back to Germany. I have some unfinished business.
I know what this means. She's going to talk to her boyfriend, tell him about me, break things off. I feel a goofy smile spread across my face. When she returns from Germany, she says, she'll meet me in New York. We can spend time together before the 1999 U.S. Open. She mentions that she'll need to call a news conference. A news conference? For what?
My retirement.
You're retiring?
That's what I just said. I'm done.
When you said done, I thought you meant done for the tournament. I didn't know you meant done. I feel bereft. Thinking of tennis without Stephanie Graf, the greatest women's player of all time. I ask how it feels knowing she'll never swing a racket in competition again. It's the kind of question reporters ask me every day, but I can't help myself. I want to know. I ask with a mixture of curiosity and envy. She says it feels fine. She's at peace, more than ready to be done. I wonder if I'm ready. I meditate on my own tennis mortality. But a week later, I'm in Washington, D.C., playing Kafelnikov in the final. I beat him 7-6, 6-1, and afterward I give his coach, Larry, a look. A promise is a promise. I realize I'm not done. I have promises yet to keep. I'm on the verge of being number one again. This time, it's not my father's goal, or Perry's, or Brad's, and I remind myself that it's not mine either. It would be nice, that's all. It would cap off the comeback. It would be a memorable milestone on the journey. I sprint up one side of Gill Hill, down the other. I'm training for the number one ranking, I tell Gil, and for the U.S. Open, and, in a funny way, for Stephanie. I can't wait for you to meet her, I say. She arrives in New York, and I whisk her upstate to a friend's 19th century farmhouse. It has 1,500 acres and several large stone fireplaces. In every room we can sit and stare into the flames and talk. I tell her I'm a firebug.
Me too,
she says.
The leaves are just starting to turn, and each window frames a postcard view of red gold woods and mountains. There is no one around for miles. We spend our time walking, hiking, driving into nearby towns, puttering in antique shops. At night, we lie on the couch and watch the original Pink Panther. After half an hour, we're both laughing so hard at Peter Sellers that we have to stop the tape and catch our breath. She leaves after 3 days. She has to go on holiday with her family. I beg her to come back for the final weekend of the U.S. Open, to be there for me, in my box. I wonder if I'm jinxing myself, presuming that I'll be playing on the final weekend, but I don't care. She says she'll try. I reach the semis. I'm scheduled to play Kafelnikov. Stephanie phones and says she'll come, but she won't sit in my box. She's not ready for that. Well then, let me arrange a seat for you.
I'll find my own seat, she says. Don't worry about me. I know my way around that place.
I laugh. I guess so.
She watches from the upper deck, wearing a baseball cap pulled low over her eyes. Of course, the CBS cameras pick her out of the crowd, and McEnroe, doing commentary, says U.S. Open officials should be ashamed, not getting Steffi Graf a better seat. I beat Kafelnikov again. Tell Larry I said hello. In the final I face Martin. I thought it would be Pete. I said publicly that I wanted Pete, but he pulled out of the tournament with a bad back. So it's Martin, who's been there, across the net, at so many critical junctures. At Wimbledon, in 1994, when I was still struggling to absorb Brad's teachings, I lost to Martin in a nip-and-tuck five-setter. At the U.S. Open that same year, Lupica predicted that Martin would upend me in the semis, and I believed him, but still managed to beat Martin and win the tournament. In Stuttgart, in 1997, it was my appalling first-round loss to Martin that finally pushed Brad to the breaking point. Now, it's Martin who will be a test of my newfound maturity, who will show if the changes in me are fleeting or meaningful. I break him in the very first game. The crowd is solidly behind me. Martin doesn't hang his head, however, doesn't lose any poise. He makes me work for the first set, then comes out stronger in the second, taking it in a tight tiebreak. He then wins the third set in an even tighter tiebreak. He leads 2-1, a commanding lead at this tournament. No one ever comes back from such a deficit in the final here. It hasn't happened in 26 years. I see in Martin's eyes that he's feeling it and waiting for me to show the old cracks in my mental armor. He's waiting for me to crumble, to revert to that jittery, emotional Andre he's played so often in years past. But I neither fold nor yield. I win the fourth set, 6-3, and in the fifth set, with Martin looking spent, I'm on the balls of my feet. I win the set, 6-2, and walk away knowing I'm healed. I'm back, exulting that Stephanie was here to see it. I've made only 5 unforced errors in the final 2 sets. Not once all day have I lost my serve, the first 5-setter of my career in which I haven't lost my serve, and it comes as I capture my 5th slam. When I get back to Vegas, I want to put 500 on number 5 at a roulette table. In the press room, one reporter asks why I think the New York crowd was pulling for me, cheering so loudly. I wish I knew, but I take a guess. They've watched me grow up. Of course, fans everywhere have watched me grow up, but in New York, their expectations were higher, which helped accelerate and validate my growth. It's the first time I felt, or dared to say aloud, that I'm a grown-up. Stephanie flies with me to Vegas. We do all the typical Vegas-y things. We gamble, see a show,
take in a boxing match with Brad and Kimmy. Oscar De La Hoya versus Felix Trinidad. Our first official public date. Our coming out party. The next day, a photo of us holding hands, kissing at ringside, appears in newspapers. No turning back now, I tell her. She stares, then slowly, thankfully, smiles. She spends the weekend at my house. The weekend turns into a week, then a month. JP phones one day and asks how things are going. I've never been better. When are you going to see Stephanie again? She's still here. What do you mean? I cup my hand over my mouth and whisper, it's still date three. She hasn't left. Well, what? I assume she'll leave eventually, go back to Germany, get her stuff, but we don't talk about it, and I don't want to bring it up. I don't want to do anything to disrupt things. The way you're not supposed to wake a sleepwalker. But soon, it's time for me to go back to Germany, to play Stuttgart. She wants to come along. She even agrees to sit in my box, and I'm delighted to have her there with me. After all, Stuttgart is an important city for us both. It's where she turned pro, and where I returned pro. And yet, we don't talk about tennis on the flight. We talk kids. I tell her I want them, with her. A bold thing to say, but I can't help myself. She takes my hand, tears in her eyes, and looks out the window. On our last morning in Stuttgart, Stephanie needs to get up early. She has an early flight. She kisses my forehead goodbye. I pull the pillow over my head and go back to sleep. When I wake an hour later and stumble to the bathroom, I see, lying in my open shaving kit, Stephanie's birth control pills, as if to say, I won't be needing these anymore. I not only reach number one, I finish 1999 number one, the first time I've ever ended a year in the top slot. I snap Pete's streak of 6 year-end finishes at number one. I then win the Paris Open and become the first man ever to win the Paris Open and the French Open in the same year. But at the ATP World Tour Championship, I lose to Pete, our 28th meeting. He leads 17-11. In slam finals, he leads 3-1. Not much of a rivalry, sports writers say, since Pete usually wins. I can't argue, and I can't be upset about Pete anymore. I do the only thing I can do. I go to Gil's house and burn muscles. I run up and down Gil Hill until I see visions. I run in the morning. I run in the evening. I run on Christmas Eve, Gil timing me with a stopwatch. He says I'm breathing so loudly when I reach the top of the hill that he can hear me from the bottom. I run until I lean over the sticker bushes and vomit. Finally, he meets me at the summit and tells me to stop. We stand and look at all the Christmas lights in the distance, and then we watch for shooting stars.
I'm proud of you, he says. Being out here tonight, Christmas Eve, it says something.
I thank him for being out here with me, for giving up his Christmas Eve. Must be so many other places you'd rather be.
No place I'd rather be, he says.
As the 2000 Australian Open begins, I beat Mariano Puerta in straight sets, and he publicly praises my concentration. I feel it. I'm on a collision course with Pete again, and sure enough, we face off in the semis. I've lost 4 of the last 5 times we've played, and he's as good this day as ever. He hits me with 37 aces, more than he's ever notched against me. But I've got Christmas Eve with Gil. 2 points from losing the match, I mount a furious comeback. I win the match and become the first man since Laver to reach the final in 4 straight slams. In the final, I face Kafelnikov again.
It takes time to warm up. I'm still rubbery after my tussle with Pete. I lose the first set, but find my stride, my touch, and take him in four. My sixth slam. At the post-match news conference, I thank Brad and Gil for teaching me that my best is good enough. A fan shouts out Stephanie's name, asks, "What's the story there?"
"Mind your business," I say, joking.
I'd actually like to tell the world about it, and I will, soon. Gil tells the New York Times,
"I really believe we will never see Andre stop fighting ever again."
Brad tells the Washington Post,
"He's got a 27-1 match record over the last four Grand Slams. Only Rod Laver, Don Budge, and Steffi Graf have ever done better."
Even Brad doesn't fully realize how floored I am to be mentioned in that company. Chapter 25. Stephanie tells me her father is coming to Vegas for a visit. Her parents are long divorced, and her mother, Heidi, already lives 15 minutes from us. Thus, the unavoidable moment has arrived. Our fathers are going to meet. The prospect unnerves us both. Peter Graf is suave, sophisticated, well-read. He likes to make jokes, lots of jokes, none of which I get, because his English is spotty. I want to like him, and I see he wants me to like him, but I am uneasy in his presence because I know the history. He's the German Mike Agassi, a former soccer player, a tennis fanatic. He started Stephanie playing before she was out of diapers. Unlike my father, however, Peter never stopped managing her career and her finances, and he spent 2 years in jail for tax evasion. The subject never comes up, but feels at times like the German elephant in the room. I should have expected it. The first thing Peter wants to see when he arrives in Nevada isn't Hoover Dam or the Strip, but my father's ball machine. He's heard all about it, and now he wants to study it up close. I drive him to my father's house, and along the way he chatters amiably. But I don't understand much. Is it German? No, it's a hybrid of German and English and tennis. He's asking questions about my father's game. How often does my father play? How well does he play? He's trying to size up my father before we get there. My father doesn't do well with people who don't speak perfect English, and he doesn't do well with strangers. So I know we have two strikes on us as we walk through my parents' front door. I'm relieved, however, to see that sport is a universal language, that these two men, both aficionados, both former athletes, know how to use their bodies to communicate through swings and gestures and grunts. I tell my father that Peter would like to see the famous ball machine. My father is flattered. He takes us outside to his backyard court and wheels out the Dragon. He revs the motor, raises the pedestal high. He's talking nonstop, giving Peter a lecture, shouting to be heard above the Dragon, blissfully unaware that Peter doesn't understand a word.
"Go stand there," my father tells me.
He hands me a racket, points me to the other side of the court, aims the machine at my head.
"Demonstrate,"
he says. I'm having shuddering, violent flashbacks, and only the thought of the tequila waiting for me back home keeps me functioning. Peter positions himself behind me and watches while I hit.
"Ah,"
he says.
"Yeah, good."
My father cranks up the machine. He clicks the dial until the balls are coming almost in twos. My father must have added a gear to the Dragon. I don't remember balls ever coming this fast. I don't have time to bring back my racket and hit the second ball. Peter scolds me for missing. He takes the racket from me, pushes me aside.
"This," he says, "is the shot you should have had. You never had this shot."
He shows me the famous Stephanie slice, which he claims to have taught Stephanie.
You need a quieter racket, he says. Like this.
My father is livid. In the first place, Peter isn't listening to my father's lecture. In the second place, Peter is interfering with my father's star pupil. My father comes around the net, shouting,
That slice is bullshit. If Stephanie had this shot, she would have been better off.
He then demonstrates the two-handed backhand he taught me.
With this shot, my father says, Stephanie would have won 32 slams.
The two men can't understand each other, and yet they're managing a heated argument. I turn my back, concentrate on hitting balls. I train all my attention on the dragon. Occasionally, I hear Peter mention my rivals, Pete and Rafter, and then my father responds with Stephanie's nemesis, Monica Seles and Lindsay Davenport. My father then mentions boxing. He uses a boxing analogy, and Peter howls in protest.
I was a boxer too, Peter says, and I would have knocked you out.
You can say a lot of things to my father, but not that. Never that. I cringe, knowing what's coming. I wheel just in time to see Stephanie's 63-year-old father take off his shirt and tell my 69-year-old father,
Look at me. Look at the shape I'm in. I'm taller than you. I can keep you at bay with my jab.
My father says,
You think so? Come on, you and me.
Peter is trash-talking in German. My father is trash-talking in Assyrian, and they're both putting up their fists. They're circling, feinting, bobbing and weaving, and just before one of them throws hands, I step in, push them apart. My father shouts,
This fucker is talking shit!
That may be, Pops, but please. They're winded, sweating. My father's eyes are dilated. Peter's bare chest is beaded with sweat. They see, however, that I'm not going to let them mix it up. So they go to neutral corners. I turn off the dragon, and we all walk off the court. At home, Stephanie kisses me and asks how it went. I'll tell you later, I say, reaching for the tequila. I don't know when a margarita has ever tasted so good. After playing well in the Davis Cup, I lose early in Scottsdale, a tournament I typically own. I play poorly in Atlanta and pull a hamstring. I lose in the third round in Rome and realize, reluctantly, that this can't go on. I can't play every tournament. Approaching 30 years old, I must choose my battles more carefully. Every other interview now is about the end. I tell reporters that my best tennis is ahead of me, and they smile, wincingly, as if they hope I'm kidding. I've never been more serious. When the time comes to defend at the 2000 French Open, I walk into Roland Garros expecting to feel waves of nostalgia. But it's all different. The place has been renovated. They've added more seats. They've redone the locker rooms. I don't like it. Not one bit. I wanted Roland Garros to stay the same forever. I want everything to stay the same. I hoped to walk on center court every year and conjure up 1999, when life changed. At the news conference after my win against Medvedev, I told reporters that I could now leave tennis with no regrets. But 1 year later, I realize that I was wrong. I will always have one regret, that I can't go back and relive the 1999 French Open again and again. In the second round, I face Kuchera. He always has my number. The mere sight of me fills him with a quart of adrenaline. Even when I see him in the locker room before our match, he looks as if he's just reminiscing about the time he beat me at the 1998 U.S. Open. He comes out playing superbly, running me ragged, and though I'm keeping pace, I develop blisters all over my right foot. I limp to the side and ask for an injury timeout. A trainer retapes my foot, but the real blister is on my brain. I don't win another game from that point on. I look up at my box. Stephanie has her head down. She's never seen me lose like this. Later, I tell her that I don't understand why I sometimes come apart. Still, she gives me insights from her experience.
Stop thinking, she says. Feeling is the thing. Feeling.
It's nothing I haven't heard before. It sounds like a sweeter, softer version of my father. But when Stephanie says it, the words go in deeper. We talk for days about thinking versus feeling. She says it's one thing not to think, but you can't then decide to feel. You can't try to feel. You have to let yourself feel. Other times, Stephanie knows there is nothing to be said. She touches my cheek and tilts her head, and I see that she gets it, that she's been there, and that's enough. That's exactly what I need. We go to the 2000 Wimbledon. I take great pleasure in watching Stephanie explore London. At last, she says, she can actually see this beautiful city because she's not looking at it through a haze of pressure and injuries. Tennis players travel as much as any athletes, but the stress and rigors of the game keep us from seeing. Now, Stephanie gets to see everything. She walks everywhere, exploring all the shops and parks. She drops into a famous pancake restaurant she's always wanted to try. It serves 150 different kinds of pancake, and she samples just about every kind, without having to worry about feeling heavy-footed on the court. True to form, I see nothing in London but my draw. With blinders on, I fight my way to the semis. I face Rafter. He's putting together a beautiful career. Two-time U.S. Open champ. Former number one. Now they say he's trying to come back from shoulder surgery, though he's acing me left and right. When he's not acing me, he's dancing in behind his serve, letting nothing pass. I try lobbing him. I hit what feel like unreturnable shots as they leave my racket, but he always gets back in time. We play for 3.5 hours, high-quality tennis, and it all comes down to the 6th game of the 5th set. Trying to put something extra on a second serve, I double fault. Break point. I serve, he hits a crisp return, I net the ball. I can't break him back. He's landing 74% of his first serves, and he first serves his way into the final. He's earned the right to play Pete for the championship. I wanted to play Pete with Stephanie watching, but it's not to be. A year ago, I beat Rafter here in the semis, when he felt the first twinges in his shoulder. Now he comes back and beats me in the semis with his shoulder fully healed. I like Rafter, and I like the symmetry. I can't argue with that storyline. Stephanie and I fly home. I need rest. Then the bad news starts pouring in. My sister Tammy has gotten a diagnosis of breast cancer. Days later, my mother gets the same diagnosis. I give up my spot on the Olympic team going to Sydney. I want to spend as much time as possible with my family. I need to shut down for the year until January at least. My mother won't hear of it.
Go, she says.
Play. Do your job.
I try. I go to D.C., but play the way I always do when I can't concentrate. Against Koretsa, I break 3 rackets in anger and lose in 2 spiritless sets. At the 2000 U.S. Open, I'm the number one seed, the favorite to win it. On the eve of the tournament, I sit with Gil at the Lowell Hotel, feeling not favored, but fucked. It should be a happy time. I could win this thing. I could shock the world. And I don't care. Gil, why go on?
Maybe you shouldn't.
Why do I feel this way, the old way, again? It's a rhetorical question.
Casey is fully recovered, thriving, talking about college, but Gil never forgets what it's like to have someone you love lying in a hospital bed. He knows what I'm saying without my saying it. Why must the people we love suffer? Why can't life be perfect? Why, every day, somewhere on this earth, does someone have to lose?
You can't play, Gil says, unless you feel inspired. That's your nature. That's always been your nature, since you were 19 years old. But you can't feel inspired unless the people around you are okay. I love you for that.
I'm letting people down if I don't play. I'm letting my family down if I do. He nods. Why do tennis and life always seem opposed? He says nothing. We've done it, haven't we? I mean, we've run the race, right? We're at the end of this bullshit, no?
I can't answer that, he says. I only know that there is still more inside you, and there is more inside me. If we walk away, fine. But we still have something left, and I think you promised yourself that you were going to see your game to the finish line.
On the first day of practice hitting with Brad, I can't make a serve to save my life. I walk off the court, and Brad knows not to ask. I go back to the hotel and lie on the bed and stare at the ceiling for 2 hours, knowing I'm not going to be in New York for long. In the first round, I play a Stanford student, Alex Kim, who's sick with anxiety. I feel for him, but take him out in straight sets. In the second round, I meet Clément. It's a hot day, and we both have a full sweat going before the first point. I start fine, break him, go ahead 3-1. All's well. Then, suddenly, I've never played tennis before. In front of a packed house, I disintegrate. Again, the sports writers sound the old dirge. The end nears for Agassi. Gil tries to tell them what I'm going through. He says,
Andre is fueled by his heart, emotions, and beliefs, and those he holds dearest to him. When all is not well, you can see it in his actions.
On the way out of Arthur Ashe Stadium, a young girl says,
I'm sorry you lost.
Oh, honey, don't be too sorry. She smiles. I hurry home to Vegas to spend time with my mother, but she's untroubled, absorbed in her books and jigsaw puzzles, putting the rest of us to shame with her unshakable calm. I see that I've underestimated her through the years. I've mistaken her silence for weakness, acquiescence. I see that she is what my father made her, as we all are, and yet, beneath the surface, she's so much more. I also see that, in this perilous moment of her life, she'd like a little credit. I've always taken it for granted that my mother wanted to be taken for granted, that she wanted to blend into the woodwork. But what she wants right now is to be noticed, appreciated. She wants me to know that she's stronger than I suspected. She's getting her treatments, not complaining, and if she takes pride in this, if she wants me to be proud, she also wants me to know I'm made of the same stuff. She survived my father, as did I. She'll survive this, and I will too. Tammy, getting treatment in Seattle, is also doing better. She's had surgery, and before she starts chemotherapy, she comes to Vegas to spend time with the family. She tells me she's dreading the loss of her hair. I tell her I don't know why. Losing my hair was the best thing that ever happened to me. She laughs. She says maybe it would be a good idea to get rid of her hair before the cancer takes it. An act of defiance, a seizing of control. I like the sound of that, I say. I'll help. We arrange a barbecue at my house, and before everyone arrives, we shut ourselves into a bathroom. With only Philly and Stephanie as witnesses, we hold a formal head-shaving ceremony. Tammy wants me to do the honors. She hands me the electric shearer. I set the blade at 000, the tightest setting,
and ask if she wants a mohawk first. This might be your last chance to see how you look with one.
No, she says. Let's just go for broke.
I shave her fast and close. She smiles like Elvis on the day he went into the army. As her hair cascades to the floor, I tell her everything's going to be great. You're free now, Tammy. Free. Also, I tell her, at least your hair will grow back. With me and Philly, it's gone forever, baby. She laughs and laughs, and it feels good to make my sister laugh when every day does its best to make her cry. By November 2000, my family is sufficiently on the mend that I'm ready to train again. In January, we fly to Australia. I feel good when we land. I do love this place. I must have been an Aborigine in another life. I always feel at home here. I always enjoy walking into Rod Laver Arena, playing under Laver's name. I bet Brad that I'm going to win the whole thing. I can feel it. And when I do, he will have to jump in the Yarra River, a fetid, polluted tributary that wends through Melbourne. I batter my way to the semis and face Rafter again. We play 3 hours of hammer and tong tennis, filled with endless I-grunt, U-grunt rallies. He's ahead 2-1. Then he withers, the Australian heat. We're both drenched with sweat, but he's cramping. I win the next 2 sets. In the final, I face Clément, a grudge match 4 months after he knocked me out of the U.S. Open. I rarely leave the baseline. I make few mistakes, and those I do make, I put quickly behind me. While Clément is muttering to himself in French, I feel a serene calm. My mother's son. I beat him in straight sets. It's my 7th slam, putting me 10th on the all-time list. I'm tied with McEnroe, Wielander, and others. 1 ahead of Becker and Edberg. Wielander and I are the only ones to win 3 Australian Opens in the Open era. At the moment, however, all I care about is seeing Brad do the backstroke in the Yarra, then getting home to Stephanie. We spend the early part of 2001 nesting at Bachelor Pad 2, converting it from Bachelor Pad to proper home. We shop for furniture that we both like. We give small dinner parties. We talk late into the night about the future. She buys me a kitchen chalkboard for honeydew lists, but I convert it into an appreciation board. I hang the board on the kitchen wall and promise Stephanie that every evening I'll write something about my love for her, and the next evening I'll wipe the board clean and write something new. I also buy a crate of 1989 Bay Chevelle, and we promise to share a bottle every year on the anniversary of our first date. At Indian Wells, I reach the final and face Pete. I beat him, and in the locker room after the match, he tells me he's going to marry Bridget Wilson, the actress he's been dating.
I'm still allergic to actress, I say. He laughs, but I'm not kidding.
He tells me he met her on the set of a movie, Love Stinks. I laugh, but he's not kidding. There is much I want to say to Pete about marriage, about actresses, but I can't. Ours isn't that kind of relationship. There is much I'd like to ask him about how he stays so focused, about whether or not he regrets devoting so much of his life to tennis. Our different personalities, our ongoing rivalry, precludes such intimacy. I realize that despite the effect we've had on each other, despite our quasi-friendship, we're strangers, and may always be. I wish him the best, and I mean it. To my mind, being with the right woman is true happiness. After all the time I've spent putting together my so-called team, the only thing I want now is to feel like a valued member of Stephanie's team. I hope he feels the same way about his fiancée. I hope he cares as much about his place in her heart as he seems to care about his place in history. I wish I could tell him so.
An hour after the tournament, Stephanie and I give a tennis lesson. Wayne Gretzky bought us at a charity auction, and he wants us to teach his kids. We have fun with the Gretzkys. Then, as darkness falls, we drive slowly back to Los Angeles. Along the way, we talk about how cute the kids were. I think of the Costner kids. Stephanie squints out the window, then at me. She says, I think I'm late.
What for?
Late. Oh, you mean, oh. We stop at several drugstores, buy every kind of pregnancy test on the shelves, then hole up at the Hotel Bel Air. Stephanie goes into the bathroom, and when she comes out, her expression is unreadable. She hands me the stick. Blue.
What does blue mean?
I think it means, you know.
A boy?
I think it means I'm pregnant.
She does the test again, and again. Blue every time. It's what we both wanted, and she's delighted, but frightened too. So many changes. What will happen to her body? We only have a few hours left together before I catch a red-eye to Miami and she flies to Germany. We go out to dinner to Matsuhisa. We sit at the sushi bar, holding hands, telling each other it's going to be fantastic. I don't realize until later that this is the same restaurant where it all unraveled with Brooke. Just like tennis, the same court on which you suffer your bloodiest defeat can become the scene of your sweetest triumph. After we're done eating and crying and celebrating, I say, I guess we should get married. Her eyes widen.
I guess so.
There will be no hoopla, we decide. No church, no cake, no dress. We'll do it on a free day during a lull in the tennis season. I sit down for an hour-long interview with Charlie Rose, the genial TV host, during which I lie through my teeth. I don't mean to lie, but each question Rose asks seems to come with an implied answer, an answer he's ready and eager to hear.
Did you love tennis at an early age?
Yes.
You loved the game.
I would sleep with a racket.
You look back on what your father did for you. Do you say now, I'm glad that he gave me those early things that made me tough?
I'm definitely glad that I play tennis. I'm glad my dad started me in tennis. I sound as though I've been hypnotized or brainwashed, which isn't new. I say the same things I've said before, the same things I've mouthed during countless news conferences and interviews and cocktail party conversations. Are they lies if I've come to partially believe them? Are they lies if, through sheer repetition, they've taken on a veneer of truth? This time, however, the lies sound and feel different. They hang in the air. They have a bitter aftertaste. When the interview is over, I feel a vague queasiness. Not guilt so much, but regret. A sense of missed opportunity. I wonder what would have happened, what Rose might have done or said, how much more we might have enjoyed the hour if I'd leveled with him and with myself. Actually, Charlie, I hate tennis. The queasiness stays with me for days. It gets worse when the interview airs. I promise myself that one day I'll look an interviewer of Rose's stature right in the eye and tell him the unvarnished truth. At the 2001 French Open, an invisible person is in my box. Stephanie is 4 months along, and the presence of our unborn child gives me the legs of a teenager. I reach the round of 16 and play Squillari, with whom I have such history. It feels as we walk onto the court as if we have more history than France has with England. The sight of Squillari takes me straight back to 1999, one of the toughest matches of my career. One of the turning points. If he'd beaten me that day, 2 years ago, I don't know if I'd be here. I don't know if Stephanie would be here, and therefore our unborn child wouldn't be here. Inspired by these thoughts, I'm locked in. As the match wears on, I grow fresher, more focused. My concentration is unbreakable. An unruly fan yells something obscene about me. I laugh. I take a nasty fall, twisting and cutting my knee. I shrug it off. Nothing can deter me, least of all Squillari. Gradually, I lose all awareness of him. I'm out here by myself, more so than usual. In the quarters, I play Sébastien Grosjean from France. I breeze through the first set, losing only one game. Then Grosjean taps into some hidden reservoir of faith that he can win. Now our self-confidence is equal, but his shot-making is superior. He breaks me to go up 2-0, then breaks me again and wins the second set as easily as I won the first. In the third set, he breaks me right away, winning the game with a pretty lob. Then he holds, then breaks me again. I'm done for. In the fourth set, I have chances to break his serve, but I can't capitalize. I hit a backhand that's weak, unworthy of me, and as I watch it sail wide, I know I'm running out of time. He's serving for the match. I'm holding on by my fingernails, and then I net a forehand. Match point. He closes me out with an ace. Afterward, reporters ask if my concentration was broken by the arrival of President Clinton. Of all the reasons I've ever heard and offered for losing a match, even I couldn't come up with one that lame. I didn't even know Clinton was there, I tell them. I had other things on my mind, other invisible spectators. I bring Stephanie to Gill's gym under the guise of a workout. She's beaming, because she knows why we're really here. Gill asks Stephanie if she's feeling all right, if she'd like something to drink, if she'd like to sit. He guides her to an exercise cycle, and she mounts side saddle. She studies the shelf Gill has built along one wall to hold the trophies from my slams, including those I've had replaced since my post-friend's tantrum. I fiddle with a stretching cord and then say, So, Gil, listen. We've picked out a name for our son.
Aw, what is it?
Jaden.
I like that,
Gil says, smiling, nodding.
Yes, I do. I like that.
And we also think we've got the perfect middle name.
What's that?
Gil. He stares. I say, Jaden Gill Agassi. If he grows up to be half the man you are, he'll be phenomenally successful. And if I can be half the father you've been to me, I'll have surpassed my own standards. Stephanie is crying. My eyes are filled with tears. Gill is standing 10 feet away in front of the leg extension machine. He has his trademark pencil behind his ear, his glasses on the end of his nose, his Da Vinci notebook open. He reaches me in 3 steps and folds me in his arms. I feel his necklace against my cheek. Father, Son, Holy Ghost. I'm close to beating Rafter at the 2001 Wimbledon. 5th set, serving for the match. 2 points from winning. I net a tentative forehand. On the next point, I miss an easy backhand. He's broken back. Now it's he who thinks he's close to beating me. I shout, Motherfucker! A lineswoman promptly reports me to the umpire. I get an obscenity warning. Now I can think of nothing but this busybody lineswoman. I lose the set 8-6 and the match. It feels disappointing and unimportant at the same time. Along with Stephanie's health and our budding family, my thoughts are never far from my school, which is due to open this fall, with 200 students, grades 3 through 5, though we have plans to expand quickly to include kindergarten through 12th grade. In 2 years, we'll have the middle school built. In another 2 years, the high school. I love our concepts, our designs, but I'm particularly proud of our commitment to putting money behind our ideas. Lots of money.
Perry and I were horrified to learn that Nevada spends less than almost any other state on education, $6,800 per pupil, as compared with the national average of nearly $8,600. Thus, at my school, we vowed to make up the difference, and then some. Through a mix of state funding and private donors, we're going to invest heavily in kids and thereby prove that in education, as in all things, you get what you pay for. Also, we're going to keep our kids in school more hours each day, 8 instead of Nevada's customary 6. If I've learned nothing else, it's that time and practice equal achievement. Further, we're going to insist that parents become intimately involved with the school. At least one parent per child will be required to spend 12 hours a month volunteering as a student aide in the classrooms or a monitor on school trips. We want parents to feel like shareholders. We want them fully committed and responsible for getting their children into college. Many days, when I feel run down or low, I drive to the neighborhood and watch the school take shape. Of all my contradictions, this is the most amazing and the most amusing. A boy who despised and feared school becomes a man inspired and re-energized by the sight of his own school being built. I can't be there on opening day, however. I'm playing in the 2001 U.S. Open. I'm playing for the school, therefore playing my best. I burn through 4 rounds and meet Pete in the quarters. From the moment we come out of the tunnel, we know this will be our fiercest battle yet. We just know. It's the 32nd time we've played. He leads 17-14, and each of us wears an unusually grim game face. Right here, right now, this one will decide the rivalry. Winner take all. Pete is supposed to be at half speed. He hasn't won a slam in 14 months. He's been balky and openly talking retirement, but all of that is irrelevant because he's playing me. Still, I win the first set in a tiebreak, and now I feel good about my chances. I have a 49-1 record at this tournament when I win the first set. Someone please remind Pete of the stats. He wins the second set in a tiebreak. The third set also goes to a tiebreak. I make several foolish mistakes. Fatigue. He wins the third set. In the fourth set, we have several epic rallies. We go to still another tiebreak. We've played 3 hours, and neither of us has yet broken the other's serve. It's after midnight. The fans, 23,000 plus, rise. They won't let us start the fourth tiebreak. Stomping and clapping, they're staging their own tiebreak. Before we press on, they want to say thanks. I'm moved. I see that Pete is moved. But I can't think about the fans. I can't let myself think about anything but reaching the sanctuary of a fifth set. Pete knows that the advantage tips in my direction if this goes 5 sets. He knows that he needs to play a perfect tiebreak to prevent a fifth set. And so he does. A night of flawless tennis ends with my forehand in the net. Pete screams. I actually feel my pulse decrease. I don't feel bad. I try to feel bad, but I can't. I wonder if I'm growing accustomed to losing to Pete in big matches, or simply growing content with my career and life. Whatever the case, I put my hand on Pete's shoulder and wish him well. And though it doesn't feel like goodbye, it feels like a rehearsal for a goodbye that can't be far off. In October 2001, 3 days before Stephanie is due to give birth, we invite our mothers and a Nevada judge to the house. I love watching Stephanie with my mother, the 2 shy women in my life. Stephanie often brings her a couple of new jigsaw puzzles, and I adore Stephanie's mother, Heidi. She looks like Stephanie, so she had me at Guten Tag. Stephanie and I, barefoot and wearing jeans, stand before the judge in the courtyard. For wedding bands, we use twists of old raffia Stephanie found in a drawer,
the same stuff I used to decorate her first birthday card. Neither of us notices the coincidence until later. My father insists he's not the least bit slighted by not getting an invite. He doesn't want an invite. The last thing he wants to do is attend a wedding. He doesn't like weddings. He walked out in the middle of my first. He doesn't care where or when or how I make Stephanie my wife, he says, so long as I do it. She's the greatest women's tennis player of all time, he says. What's not to like? The judge runs through his legal rigmarole, and Stephanie and I are just about to say, I do, when a team of landscapers arrive. I run outside and ask them to please turn off their lawnmowers and leaf blowers for 5 minutes so that we can get married. They apologize. One holds a finger over his lips.
By the power vested in me, the judge says.
And at last, at long last, with two mothers and three landscapers looking on, Steffi Graf becomes Stephanie Agassi. Chapter 26. A season of birth and rebirth. Weeks after my school opens, my son arrives. In the delivery room, when the doctor hands me Jaden Gill, I feel bewildered. I love him so much that my heart splits open like something overripe. I can't wait to get to know him, and yet. I also wonder, just who is this beautiful intruder? Are Stephanie and I ready for a perfect stranger in the house? I'm a stranger to myself. What will I be to my son? Will he like me? We bring Jaden home, and I spend hours staring at him. I ask him who he is, where he came from, what he'll be. I ask myself how I can be everything to him that I needed and never had. I want to retire immediately, spend all my time with him. But now, more than ever, I need to play. For him, his future, and my other children at my school. My first match as a father is a win against Rafter at the Tennis Masters Series tournament in Sydney. I tell reporters afterward that I doubt I'll be able to do this long enough that my new son will get to see me play, but it sure is a nice dream. Then I pull out of the 2002 Australian Open. My wrist is throbbing, and I can't compete. Brad is frustrated. I wouldn't expect anything less. But this time, he has trouble brushing aside his frustration. This time is different. Days later, he says we need to talk. We meet for coffee, and he lays it out.
We've had a great run, Andre, but we've gone as far as we can go. We're growing stagnant, creatively. I've burned through my bag of tricks, buddy. But we've had 8 years. We could go on a few more, but you're 32. You have a new family, new interests. Might not be such a bad idea to find a new voice for your home stretch. Someone to remotivate you.
He pauses. He looks at me, then looks away.
Bottom line, he says, we're so close. My worst fear is that we get into an argument as the end approaches, and it carries over.
I think that could never happen, but better safe than sorry. We hug. As he walks out the door, I feel the kind of melancholy you feel on a Sunday night after an idyllic weekend. I know Brad does, too. It might not be the right way to end our journey, but it's the best way possible. I close my eyes and try to picture myself with someone new. The first face I see is Darren Cahill. He's just finished a brilliant span coaching Leighton Hewitt, who's ranked number one, and among the best shot selectors in the history of tennis, and a great deal of the credit must go to Darren. Also, I recently bumped into Darren down in Sydney, and we had a long talk about fatherhood. It was a bonding moment. Darren, a fellow new father, turned me onto a book about getting infants to sleep. He swore by this book and said his son is known on tour as the baby who sleeps like a drunkard. I've always liked Darren. I like his easygoing style. I find his Aussie accent soothing. It almost puts me to sleep. I read the book he recommended and phoned Stephanie from Australia to read her passages. It worked. Now I dial him and tell him I've parted from Brad. I ask if he has any interest in the job. He says he's flattered, but he's on the verge of signing to coach Safin. He'll think about it, though, and get back to me. No problem, I say. Take your time. I call him back in half an hour. I ask him, what the hell is there to think about? You can't coach Safin. He's a loose cannon. You've got to work with me. It feels right. I promise you, Darren, I have game left. I'm not done. I'm focused. I just need someone to help me keep the focus.
Okay, he says, laughing. Okay, mate.
He never once mentions money.
Stephanie and Jaden come with me to Key Biscayne. It's April 2002, days before my 32nd birthday, and the tournament is crawling with players half my age, young Turks like Andy Roddick, the next savior of American tennis. Poor bastard. Also, there's a hot new wunderkind from Switzerland named Roger Federer. I'd like to win this tournament for my wife and six-month-old son, and yet I don't worry about losing, don't care if I lose, because of them. Each night, within minutes of coming home from the courts, as I'm cradling Jaden and cuddling Stephanie, I can barely recall if I won or lost. Tennis fades as quickly as the daylight. I almost imagine that the calluses on my playing hand are disappearing, the inflamed nerves in my back cooling and mending. I'm a father first, a tennis player second, and this evolution happens without my being aware. One morning, Stephanie goes off to buy groceries and get in a fast workout. She dares to leave me alone with Jaden, my first time flying solo. You two going to be okay? She asks. Of course. I sit Jaden on the bathroom counter, lean him against the mirror, let him play with my toothbrush while I get ready. He likes to suck on the toothbrush while watching me shave my head with the electric shearers. I ask him, what do you think of your bald daddy? He smiles. You know, son, I was once like you. Long hair flowing in every direction. You're not fooling anyone with that comb-over. He smiles wider, no idea what I'm saying, of course. I measure his hair with my fingers. Actually, you look a little ratty there, buddy. You could use a clean-up. I put a different attachment on the shearer, the attachment for trimming. When I run the shearer across Jaden's little head, however, it leaves a bright stripe of scalp down the middle, as white as a baseline. Wrong attachment. Stephanie will murder me. I need to even this boy's hair out before she gets home, but in my frantic attempt to even out the hair, I make it shorter. Before I know what's happened, my son is balder than I. He looks like mini-me. When Stephanie comes through the door, she stops in her tracks and stares, saucer-eyed.
What the... Andre, she says. What on earth is the matter with you? I leave you alone for 45 minutes and you shave the baby?
Then she lets fly a burst of histrionic German. I tell her it was an accident, the wrong attachment. I beg her forgiveness. I know, I say, it looks like I did this on purpose. I know I'm always joking about wanting to shave the world, but honest, Stephanie, this was a mistake. I try to remind her of that old wives' tale that if you shave a child's head, the hair will grow back faster and thicker. But she holds up a hand and starts laughing. She's bent over laughing. Now Jaden is laughing at Mommy laughing. Now we're all giggling, rubbing Jaden's head and mine, joking that the only one left is Stephanie, and she'd better sleep with one eye open. I'm laughing too hard to speak, and days later, in the final of Key Biscayne, I beat Federer. It's a good win. He's as hot as anyone on tour. He came into this tournament with 23 wins so far this year.
It's my 51st tournament victory, my 700th victory overall. And yet, I have no doubt I'll remember this tournament less for beating Federer than for that one belly laugh. I wonder if the laugh had something to do with the win. It's easier to be free and loose, to be yourself, after laughing with the ones you love. The right attachments.